Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The last time I went to vote, it took 2 hours. I stood in a line that snaked around a school gym, and I watched as one by one, each and every ballot scanner in the building broke. Eventually, I shoved my own ballot in an emergency box and hoped for the best. As I left, I couldn't help but wonder, did my vote count? This is a question a lot of people are asking themselves right now as we stare down another presidential election. Who counts? For some people, this is a question about whether you can get to the polls at all and what happens when you do. For others, this question, it's about a fundamental lack of representation that's built in, has been for years. As someone who lives in D.C., do you feel like you count?
Honestly, no. I'm one of those people who moved to D.C. and felt like I lost my voice.
Christina Cotarucci is a writer for Slate. And for her, like me, this idea of counting is personal. She moved to D.C. for college, which is when she realized because of where she lived, she had no senator, no vote in Congress.
That made me so angry. It felt like such a profound violation to have Congress, who, you know, we don't even have a voting member in Congress, to have them tell D.C., you know, you can't govern your own city in the way that you see fit. Like, we're subject to all of the same things that everyone else in America is, but we don't have an ability to even advocate for ourselves on the federal level.
This is a longstanding gripe in the district. The city even designed their license plate to say taxation without representation, as if it was the town motto.
I mean, it's funny because I grew up in Maryland. I saw those license plates. It always seemed like a subtle troll,
yeah,
to have those license
definitely.
Plates and kind of funny. But it sounds like for you, the funny, like it's not even funny anymore.
No, it definitely, you know, the longer I've lived here, the less funny it's seemed, because I see the effects of our disenfranchisement every day in terms of D.C.'s inability to make its own decisions for itself.
D.C. has more residents than Vermont or Wyoming. It just hasn't mattered.
For a long time, to me, it felt like an unchangeable fact. I didn't know the full history of people fighting for statehood. There was no like mass movement getting traction in Congress. So I just kind of accepted it.
Today on the show, Christina's going to talk to someone who does know that history deeply about why the fight for statehood has been such a slog and why, despite that, he's got hope that Washington's 700,000 residents might count soon. By the way, this episode, it's part of a whole new initiative here at Slate, an effort to tally up who counts in the run-up to the 2020 election. After you listen to the show, I'm going to tell you how you can be part of it. I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick with us.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Before I turn the show over to Christina, I just want to make a quick note about who she's speaking with about D.C. statehood. He's a guy named Wade Henderson. For years, he was a lobbyist for the NAACP. He lives in Washington. And he's seen how the question of who counts is deeply tied up with the question of who we value. Because who we value, that's about identity, especially race.
You know, I had read that John Lewis, the civil rights leader, had once said Wade Henderson is who he leans on when civil rights comes up in Congress. You can't really get a better endorsement than that. So the reason why I really wanted to talk to Wade was I was watching the congressional hearing on D.C. statehood a couple weeks ago. It was a big deal. It was the first hearing since 1993. And it became clear to me that the arguments that the opponents of D.C. statehood were using were basically the same ones that they were using back in 1993. A lot of them were sort of grounded in this sort of idea that D.C., this historically black majority of people of color city, was not fit to govern itself. And I wanted to talk to somebody who could help me understand that, understand the sort of racial justice argument for D.C. voting rights and also the underpinnings of the racist nature of D.C.'s disenfranchisement, which goes way back.
I'm going to let Christina take it from here.
Wade Henderson has had his hand in all manner of sticky civil rights legislation. He's used to working on problems that seem intractable. But this fight is one he's been fighting for decades. And it seems like it's just not moving.
You know, I'm especially proud to be able to say I've had a chance to work and help change the circumstances that were most offensive to me, most in need of changing. Now, within that context, the failure to get a vote for D.C. residents has been my greatest disappointment, because it's a black eye to American democracy to know that we in the nation's capital do all that we do, complying with responsibilities of citizenship, you know, going to war, paying taxes. We're larger than in many other states, and yet we are denied the most fundamental rights. And so we have our men and women, you know, advancing human rights in Kabul, Afghanistan, and in Beirut and other parts of the world, and dying for that right, and yet failing to have it at home.
Was there a moment when you realized for the first time that you had no vote for a representative in Congress or in the Senate?
It wasn't until D.C. got home rule, a version of home rule, where we had an appointed and subsequently an elected mayor and then a delegate to the House of Representatives, but without a vote. And it became readily apparent that we were different than other parts of the country.
When Wade says home rule, he's talking about D.C.'s ability to govern itself with a mayor and a city council, which the district didn't even have until 1973. Even now, Congress can still block any local bill the council passes. So back then, how prevalent were these conversations in your community? Was D.C. voting rights talked about a lot?
Not really, because the history of Washington had always been that without the right to vote. And so people who were here, particularly in the African-American community, were often migrants from the Deep South. And the fact that they came to a place that was more hospitable than the place they left was really something that was more the focus of their attention. It wasn't really until voting rights became such a national concern that D.C.'s lack of a voice in Congress and beyond really became readily apparent. It was in 1963, when I went to the March on Washington as a 15-year-old, that I began to realize the enormous power of collective action, but also the fact that we did not have the rights that we should have. Then you had the heady experience of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 65. You had Washington as a stage for national social change. You had Dr. King coming to Washington frequently and the efforts of focusing on poverty, all of that taking place. You then had, of course, his assassination, and you had the pent-up frustration that was expressed in the riots. So when Congress began intervening in the rights of D.C. residents to make decisions of their own, that's when it became really apparent, I think, that our circumstance and our status had to change. So, you know, I'd say from certainly the late 1960s onward, statehood, D.C. Residents having a full measure of citizenship became, it was woven into the local political scene. And that, to me, was a very important change, and it helped to explain where we are today.
Last month, D.C.'s non-voting delegate to Congress, Eleanor Holmes Norton, led a congressional hearing on D.C. statehood.
I want to welcome everyone to this historic hearing on H.R. 51, legislation that would make Washington, D.C. our nation's 51st state.
The hearing was a pretty big deal. This was the first time D.C. statehood had come up in the House since 1993. And the people who were there arguing against statehood, mostly congressional Republicans, plus Roger Pilon from the Cato Institute, they threw every argument they could think of at this bill. Highbrow, lowbrow, they tried everything. They said the Constitution doesn't allow Congress to make D.C. a state. They worried about their staffers having to appeal to the state of D.C. for affordable parking near the Capitol. They also did a lot of trash talking, saying D.C. hadn't proven itself worthy of statehood because of its crime rates, corruption, and school testing scores.
The arguments are consistent and have been over the years. See, when you talk about statehood, it really allows critics of that structure to attack the nation's capital. And at the hearing, some of the questions from Republican opponents focused on political problems of some of D.C.'s local leaders. And they cited examples of prior mayors and city council members who had engaged in, you know, what was perceived to be skullduggery while in office. And they used that to justify not granting statehood to the district. And of course, in every one of the states in which they live, there are ample examples of exactly this problem. So that can't be an issue in truth. And I think they focus on the fact that D.C. has such a small population.
Yeah, Vermont and Wyoming, Vermont, I think, are both, you know, smaller than D.C.
I mean, it's just outrageous. So, you know, to have that argument made is troubling. And then you can't manage your own finances.
Do you see that sort of legacy of racism that you talked about reflected in some of those arguments that you just cited? You know, D.C. has, for most of its history, been a majority black city. Now it's, I think, plurality black, still majority minority.
Yeah.
But at the congressional hearing last week, there was the guy from the Cato Institute, a libertarian, an opponent of statehood, saying, this is not about race. It may be about partisanship, some of it, but it's not about race.
You allege that this is all about race and partisanship. I grant there are partisan elements to that. This is not about race. I urge you, I request that you withdraw that charge.
It's never. Claiming.
It is about race.
Reclaiming my time.
I see you're laughing now.
I'm laughing.
What do you say to that?
Well, only because I think Americans have an extremely difficult time confronting the issue of race and its meaning for American democracy. There's a racial dynamic to this denial of voting rights, which can't be denied. It's deeply troubling. It's been in existence since D.C. itself was formed, because you had so many African Americans who came here either in service as enslaved persons or who sought freedom here. Nonetheless, we've always had a pretty substantial African-American population. And all I will say is that while attitudes over the years have changed, nonetheless, the notion of admitting a state into the becoming the 51st state has a number of implications, which I think the political establishment has had an incredibly difficult time dealing with. I mean, you know, this stuff is deeply ingrained in the American psyche. Look, we are in a system where our rights have to be measured by a single yardstick. And we are no less citizens of this country than citizens in your state, whether it's West Virginia or Alaska or Vermont or Montana. And we pay the same price and responsibility of citizens all across the country. We will not be denied that right. And the argument, the power, the moral power of that argument rests with us. So, you know, we have to be prepared to use it.
D.C. came really close to getting a vote in the House back in 2009. There was a bill that passed the Senate that would have given one voting representative each to D.C. and Utah, which was just about due for another seat, according to the recent census. Democrats liked it because D.C. would get some voting rights, and Republicans liked it because they'd be getting another seat, too. But the bill stalled out in the House.
There were some, to be fair, in the statehood community that were angry at that proposal because they felt that it would undercut the effort to get statehood and thus two senators, as well as a member of the House. My view is that by confirming our right to a voting member of the House, you have confirmed our right to the entirety of the package, that once you have accepted that change, the, a grant of voting rights in the Senate is inevitable. It will take pressure. There's no question about it. But in D.C., we lost the opportunity, and it was unique to Utah. It will never come again in quite that way.
So is this what you're talking about when you say your biggest regret is failing to secure that vote in Congress? Because, you know, in hindsight, it seems like it would have made sense.
It's my biggest disappointment. I mean, again, not everybody shares that view. But my own sense is that these changes are often secured incrementally, and that you have to be prepared to advance an agenda.
I know more than half, I believe it's 64% of the American public, when it comes to polling, currently opposes statehood. What do you think those people are misunderstanding about the statehood movement?
Well, I think what they see is, okay, why would we want another state?
Okay? The flag looks so nice as it is.
You know, exactly. We got 50. What I would say is that when the issue is framed in terms of the vote and in terms of core elements of American democracy, American people embrace that. And I think that we have an obligation to reframe the debate in ways that reach the audience we're trying to influence. You know, you come and tell somebody, I want to become a state. Well, you know, what the hell is that about? And why? Well, you know, we like you just as you are. I mean, I thought you were a state, but, you know, okay, you're not, et cetera. When you say that I need the right to vote just like you have it, and that how can you justify my not having it? And, yes, some, you know, historic quirk that can't be justified in the 21st century. Wouldn't you agree? And the answer is, yeah, generally speaking, they would agree. Now, they may disagree on the form, you know, and they may want to come up with various other proposals to thwart the idea of your being an independent player. But that's okay. Let's talk about that. But right now, let's cross that fundamental line that I have the right to a vote, and you recognize that, and we should work toward that goal.
It's obviously not going to go to the Senate this time around, considering who controls the Senate. Mitch McConnell has called it full-bore socialism.
Right.
Can't imagine Donald Trump would sign the bill even if he got it. But does it say anything about the future plausibility of statehood that now I think there's a record number of co-sponsors? I was looking at the last bill for statehood that came up in 1993, I think, and not even all the Democrats supported it. Almost half of them voted against D.C. statehood. Is there momentum right now? And what is it about this political moment that's given rise to, you know, even the ability to have a hearing around the issue?
That's a great question. There is political momentum in support of statehood, unlike any we have seen in years past. In part, it is because it's built on the efforts of past years devoted to this question, and we've seen some progress ebb and flow. But there is also a sense that, look, the time has come to express our view and to make ourselves known. And we now have a couple of things going for us. we have a democratically controlled House that's committed to advancing D.C. statehood. You wouldn't have had the hearing if that were not the case, and the likelihood of a floor vote is greater. You now have within the Congress a more diverse leadership that are more committed to this effort. Look at the number of committee chairs who are members of the Congressional Black Caucus, based in part on their seniority and on their leadership skill, and they're well respected. So I think the change in the composition of Congress has been helpful. I think the President Obama two-term tenure obviously has also changed the dynamic of elections in Washington. What was previously unthinkable has now become an historic standard, right, against which we measure the current president and others. I recognize that this process is not a perfect process, but it is the one we have. And so I'm determined to use it to the best effect.
And the way you talk about it makes it sound like it there really is sort of a straight line of progress where every push to get D.C. voting rights has gone a little bit further, gotten a little bit more support, become a little more bold. Is that how you see it?
Well, I do see it that way. I mean, I wouldn't call it a straight line. I think progress is a sort of two steps forward, one step back kind of dance. But I do think, on balance, we have made progress. With every hearing, with every generation of debate, we have made progress in moving this issue forward. So much so that, in spite of past disappointments, I remain pretty confident that the system of government that we respect, love, admire, ultimately will address this issue of voting rights for D.C. residents and will do the right thing. I'm pretty confident that when Americans are exposed to fact that contradicts their vision of what American democracy is about, they respond favorably.
How has your lifelong fight on behalf of D.C. statehood and civil rights changed you as a Washingtonian?
Oh, wow. I am a native Washingtonian, and a large part of my formative years, when I grew up, Washington was a segregated southern city with a rigidly determined racial caste. As I got older, I recognized in the 1960s that there were political events buffeting the African-American community, and they were really in sharp relief here in Washington, D.C., because at one level, we talked about being the world's greatest representative democracy. And at another level, we practiced a rigid form of racial segregation that belied all the promises of the American Constitution. Fighting for change in Washington became sort of second nature because there were, the little indignities of racism and racial segregation that for me were deeply offensive. Looking at a newspaper and seeing jobs, racially classified jobs or whites jobs for coloreds, recognizing that you were prohibited from using some of the nicer facilities in the community. I mean, here's what I would say. It inflamed me and flamed a passion for change. And I felt that those indignities were not just painful and unfair, that I was committed to changing them. I ended up going to law school in part because I was inspired to try to use the law as a tool for change. And as I said, one of the things that makes me the most proud is that I got to work on the very issues that and make the change that I hoped would see come. And that for me is the ultimate passion, satisfaction of, getting a chance to do that. So, I think D.C. and that experience helped shape my career in ways that would not have happened in almost any other place that I grew up. It was unique. And I sort of really became aware of the contradiction between, the city on the hill that, President Reagan often talked about and the way life in America operated truly. From my neighborhood, I can see the Capitol You know, I can see the monument. I'm inspired by the things that make D.C. great. But at the same time, the contradiction between the D.C. that we long for and the D.C. that is was, you know, to me, very disturbing. Yeah, so I understand progress is not linear, and sometimes it's a deep struggle. But around issues of voting rights and democracy, I'm pretty optimistic. And I think I'm pretty optimistic about D.C. and ultimately having the right to vote for its residents.
Wade Henderson is the former head of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights.
All right, that's the show. Slate is going to keep this Who Counts project going right up until the election. And we want to hear from you. What are the questions you've got? When do you feel like you yourself have counted or not? We also need your support to do this work so we can assign more stories, travel to overlooked places, and bring you more conversations like this one. If you want to support what we're doing or just track the project, go on over to slate.com/whocounts and donate. What Next is produced by Mary Wilson, Jason DeLeon, Danielle Hewitt, and Mara Silvers. I am Mary Harris. I will talk to you tomorrow.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its author's intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.